is Ryan Miller, and for the past 15 years, I've helped hundreds of people to raise millions of dollars for their funds and for their startups. If you're serious about raising money, launching your business, or taking your life to the next level, this show will give you the answers so that you too can enjoy your pursuit of making billions. Let's get into it.
In this week's episode, I bring on the CEO of Sweater and my dear friend, Jesse Randall. Join Jesse and I as we cover groundbreaking innovations that's led Jesse to bring the high-hitting profits from VC out of Wall Street and into Main Street. You don't want to miss it. Plus, Jesse shares with all of us what VCs are looking for throughout each round of fundraising so that you too will have the money-raising abilities you need in your pursuit of making billions. Here we go.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Making Billions. I'm your host, Ryan Miller, and today I have one of my dear friends, Jesse Randall. Jesse is the CEO and co-founder of Sweater. They're an evergreen VC fund out of Boulder, Colorado, and they're kind of a new type of venture fund that really brings VC out of the old boys club and brings it to the rest of the world. They're doing some fantastic things, and I cannot wait to pick Jesse's brain, and he's going to tell us all about the things that he's got going on and really how he's leading the industry on changing the world, bringing VC to Main Street. So, Jesse, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, excited to be here. Thanks for the invite, Ryan. This is great.
Yeah, so you and I have got to know each other a little bit, and I can tell you, man, I am so impressed with you call it an interval fund or an evergreen fund. It's these new types of venture capital funds that allow people to subscribe. And, you know, I don't want to steal your thunder, but man, I am so impressed with everything you've done. But before we get into all that super cool stuff that you're working on, I think myself and many of the fans around the world would love, like, who is Jesse? Where did he come from? How did he qualify? So maybe just walk us through a little bit of how you got started in this industry, and we can talk about later on the stuff you're doing. So how'd you get started in this?
No, definitely. Well, I have the unconventional path into venture. I didn't have the rich uncle. I didn't have the Ivy League degree. You know, I didn't do the management consulting that are typically shoe-ins to get into the industry. I had to build my way into it. So, yeah. I grew up actually as a farm kid outside of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. I grew up chasing cows and building barbed wire fences and stacking hay. You know, I mean, that was my life. And, my dad really emphasized to me and my siblings that education is everything. Yeah. You know, do everything you can to do better than I did. Yeah. And I was lucky enough to get out of the state and actually get a full ride scholarship that was foundational for me, ended up going on to get a graduate degree. And then I kind of tripped and fell into the world of venture capital and startups because I couldn't get a job in my desired industry of clean tech when I came out of my MBA because everything was collapsing back in 2012. And I had a favor from an alum who walked me into this job at a startup accelerator. And I didn't even know you could do that stuff professionally. And I tried to get my own ventures off the ground before that and whatnot. But I kind of stumbled into this job, ended up being the head of operations, designed an accelerator from the ground up and ran a bunch of cohorts through it. And then went off on my own, had a spectacular failure of a startup, which was a very important learning lesson for me. And the accelerator that I worked at had started a venture fund. Yeah. But they had raised it while I was there. And then when they launched it, I was on my way out and I watched them kind of trip and stumble all over themselves, as they launched. And it kind of ended up being like a bad angel network. And so I watched that failure and I thought I could do better than that and actually went to go start my own VC fund. And, it was there that I was confronted with this reality that I wouldn't be able to invest in my own fund because I was not an accredited investor. What? And I thought that was kind of absurd. And so part of my graduate work was in policy. And so I wanted to dig into the history behind accreditation requirements. And I just didn't like what I found. The overall justification for it basically says, if you're not wealthy, then you're probably not smart enough to understand this really complicated finance stuff. And we need to protect you.
Yeah.
And it was just incredibly condescending. And totally. I thought, you know, if that includes me and my siblings that are doctors and stuff that don't fall into this category yet, then this is archaic and I want to change it. So that kind of took me there, you know, and it's been a long path, but I love the world of venture and startups. And have deep empathy for founders and what it takes to actually take what's in your mind and that vision you have and and roll it into a reality. And so that's professional life. Like on a personal level, I've been married for 15 years. I have a wonderful wife. We've got a minivan full of kids and I love doing endurance sports and Ironmans and spending time in the mountains on a personal level. So it's kind of my life.
Oh man, that is incredible. So you wanted to start a venture fund and you realize even the guy starting it wouldn't qualify based on the rules, I'm assuming, that the SEC had laid out. So you did this research, you were kind of shocked, and then that led you to look for new avenues. So maybe...
Exactly.
Yeah, so maybe you can kind of walk us through a little bit about how you took... You saw the traditional model, it didn't quite represent what you were trying to do. Maybe walk us through exactly the evolution that kind of turned into Sweater now, and how it's different than the traditional venture capital market that a lot of funders and founders are used to. So maybe walk us through the difference.
Yeah, well, I mean, like if you look at the venture capital market today and just look at VC funds, they're all carbon copies of each other from a legal perspective. And there's a reason for that. There's history behind the way the SEC works and the regulations that exist.
Yeah.
You know, and VC was born coming out of the 1960s, you know, when you have like Intel and Hewlett Packard that were, you know, and other like true silicon, you know, IBM. Startups from the 60s, you know, that came out of that era. They were all funded by super angels. Venture capital didn't exist. And at the end of that decade, they all made a crap ton of money and they looked at each other. They got to, of course, along that path, they all met each other and, you know, made a lot of money together. And they said, hey, well, what if we pooled our money together? You know, like we could keep doing this and make it bigger. Yeah. But when they went to pool their money, they were confronted with the same reality that I was confronted with, except that they were accredited, obviously, because they're all very wealthy. But as a part of creating a fund, we had these requirements of a ton of regulation and oversight and auditing requirements, and just it was onerous. And so that's how it started. They went to the SEC and said, hey, you know, cut us a break. We're smart. We're rich. Like, let us lose our own money. And the SEC said, sure, that's fine. But in exchange, you know, you can only have accredited or qualified investors in the fund, and you can only have 99 investors. And that was the very beginning of this in like 1971 or something. Mm-hmm. And from there, every VC fund is a carbon copy of that exact structure. And it's never changed. You know, no one ever questioned it. It's like, well, this is the way that Sequoia did it. And this is the way Benchmark did it. So we're just going to keep rolling through it. Mm-hmm. And so that's the world that I walked into in 2018 when I went to start this fund. And you know, so obviously, like we poked around at that legal stack and said, there's got to be a, you know, loophole. There's got to be something. And there's no loophole. It's, it's just, you know, and you don't want to build a business on a loophole, even if you found one. You know, we looked at other paths. We looked at Reg A Plus and equity crowdfunding. And there's very specific provisions that say you can't pool money for the purposes of investing, which precludes raising a fund through it, of course. And so that didn't work. And we kind of were at the end of our rope. We're like, okay, maybe this just isn't possible. But then we asked a fundamental question. And the question was, you know, there's all kinds of fund structures out there, right? VC fund is one, REITs are one, hedge funds are one, you know, I mean, mutual funds are one. There's all these, there's dozens and dozens of these fund structures. And we asked a fundamental question that changed our trajectory and who we were working with. And that question was, is there a pre-existing fund structure that exists today that would allow us to take money from regular folks and invest in the same asset of private companies as VC funds, but without actually being by legal definition a VC fund? And that's what changed the game for us.
So you asked the right question. So so here you are, like a true entrepreneur, you're saying there's got to be a better way and you stuck with it. And I think you said it took you like 4 years of development to bring, you know, so you could have gone fast, but you would have just been like everybody else dealing with the same issues that everybody else dealt with. But you found a way to invent, which is the heart of the entrepreneur, which you said that you've done. And so you certainly appreciate many of the entrepreneurs that you invest in today, I would say. And so now after 4 years of planning and testing and implementing, you found a way to structure that fund vehicle to provide it to the, we'll say, the everyday investor. So maybe how does that impact what you do, and also how does that impact some of the investments that you guys make today?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AI is changing the game of business. Will you be on the winning team? I'm Jordan Wilson, the host of the Everyday AI podcast and your coach to help you learn the X's and O's of AI. Artificial intelligence isn't just a new player in the game, it's a new sport altogether. So if you don't quickly put AI into play, your competitors will run up the score. I've spent my whole life building winning teams, from coaching basketball to working with big players like Nike and Jordan Brand. My next move? Helping you win with Everyday AI. Listen wherever you get your podcasts or on everydayaipodcast.com. Let's tap into AI together and put points on the board.
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on how you define impact and like which area of impact do you want to explore? I mean, like, because it impacts a lot of stuff, right? I mean, sure. From an operational perspective, Sweater as a fund is more like a cousin to a mutual fund from an operations perspective than to a venture fund.
Okay.
So there's huge differences there that we can talk about. There's also differences in the way that capital deployment works, which changes the way that we examine startups, and our relationship with founders is a little different. In my opinion, of course, I'm biased, but in my opinion, in a better way with founders, to be able to work with them through a kind of a different lens. And, you know, at the end of the day too, you know, we're a fintech company first. We're not just a venture fund.
Yeah.
You know, so we always say we're a fintech company that happens to have an underlying venture fund.
Yeah.
And so,
cool.
You know, it's sort of like Inception. We're a venture-backed venture capital fund. Mm-hmm. And because we're venture-backed, we can also do all kinds of other interesting things with technology, with marketing that traditional VC funds are hamstrung by, that they really can't approach because they're literally taking money out of their personal pocket if they want to make investments in technology and marketing. And, you know, we gave up equity in order to have the resources to do those things. And so It brings a different kind of dynamic to the table. So there's a lot of things we could explore, but I want to make sure I go down the right rabbit hole with you.
Well, one of the things that I love that makes you a little bit different is when you and I were talking about it, you're showing me your concept. This is the coolest thing I've ever seen. So you guys have an app that customers can download and they can use that to kind of get more involved with you. Maybe walk us through a little bit on how your app is tied into the overall business model that you have.
Oh, that's a great spot to start. So
yeah
I mean, this is where we're a technology company first, right? So it's an app. You can go download it in the app store. It's available today. You go in and we walk you through this whole process, you know, helping you understand, make sure that you have a clear understanding of you know, what venture capital is as an asset class, some major components of how our fund is different than traditional VC funds. You can, you know, select amounts you want to invest, including an upfront amount and a recurring investment amount, which is something else that doesn't really exist in venture capital today.
Yes.
Connect straight to your bank account through Plaid and Stripe, and then go through the process of making an investment. You can do it in 5 minutes. You know, you can invest $500, you can invest $5 million. All of that's available through the app. And that's just the investment part, right? You get in and then you make an investment, you have a dashboard, we update you on the value of your holdings and everything over time. But then there's also a lot of educational content we put in there. And we use that to tell founder stories and provide education on venture and how the fund works.
Yeah.
And then we also have this whole section that's just, you know, I mean, it's effectively created to tell the stories of the portfolio companies that we invest in. You know, so the way that we often describe it is a reason that we made it a mobile app to be in the palm of your hand is to give you the feeling of having courtside seats to the process. You know, you don't get to go shoot the ball and you don't get to coach the team, but we will give you a tour of the locker room and you'll have, you know, individual interviews with all the players and all that. Maybe someone will fall out of bounds and get sweat on you, you know, but like that's the experience that we want to give you through the mobile app. And so, you know, we have an in-house media team and all they do all day is just produce content for you to consume and experience as a member of the community.
Oh, wow. So, right. So now I think I hope our listeners around the world are really picking up of how different, which is very positive, how different Sweater is as far as a client experience. I would say a frictionless experience. All these things that are nerdy VCs we like to look for, how you're reducing friction and customer intimacy and all these things. And you're hitting it. You're hitting all the right notes, man. Like you're just hitting those 3 points over and over again. This is amazing. So like I said in the beginning, the stuff that you guys are putting together is absolutely phenomenal. So here you are. You have an app. You got this, you're a tech company that just happens to invest in the same things that VCs do. So what kind of things do for our founders who are out there who might say, like I do, Jesse seems like a cool guy, seems like someone I would like to work with. What kind of investments, what's the arena that you guys like to play in?
So this is, when it comes to capital deployment, this is where things are also quite different from a traditional VC fund. And I think it's instructive to compare and contrast a little bit. And to be clear, there's nothing wrong with the way the traditional VC fund works. That's fine. Just different. Yeah. So traditional VC fund, say, raises $100 million. You know, they go through a 12 to 24 month process to get those commitments. They get all the commitments down. They sign everything. They have $100 million in commitments. And then they go through, you know, a 3-year-ish period of deploying that money, usually into a few dozen companies max. And that's kind of the spend cycle. And then they go do it all again and raise another fund and go do the process again. Sweater's different because the fund is evergreen, which means that we can raise money in perpetuity and into the future. You know, so we could raise $500 million or we could raise $20 billion over the course of 30 years, like whatever the case is. Yeah. And part of the evergreen structure is that we can take money constantly. Yes. So we can get into the how behind that. But basically, we can take investors in all the time. There's not a window that we're out fundraising. And it allows for unique things like an investment subscription where you can sign up and put in $500 a month and continue to grow your position over time and treat it almost like your IRA or 401k kind of thing where it's out of sight, out of mind. That money comes into the fund and then we take care of everything after that, right? So because of that constant fundraising cycle, we're not constrained to making, you know, 30 investments. We can make 300 investments. We could make 3,000 investments over a decade. Yeah. And that allows us to have a very different lens to view the startup world through. Wow. So a typical VC fund will have an investment thesis that's like, okay, we invest in this region, in these one or two or three verticals, and at this very specific stage, which, you know, if you drew a grid and you listed out all of the verticals along this axis and all the different stages along this axis, you know, a VC is going to color in like two or three of those squares that are in the middle there, and there's going to be 100 squares that they don't touch, right? But for Sweater, it's more like, I mean, we can make investments across stages, and we touch on most of the common industry verticals that are out there. So we would fill in, out of 100 squares, we'd fill in more like 60, you know, so it's a very different mentality. So to get to the core of your question, we invest in venture backable companies. So they have to be high growth. We don't invest in a brewery. We don't invest in something off of Kickstarter, typically, you know, we have to have venture scalable companies. And there's different criteria for every industry, right? Sure. And then the next one, if they make it through that and they have the DNA for it, then we have what we call as venture backable. Excuse me, what we call consumer touching, which is our thesis. So consumer touching for us is any product or service or experience that a regular person could encounter in their everyday life, either at home or at work, right? So that could be direct to consumer products. It could be apps and technology and software and marketplaces that you access on your phone or through the internet, or it could even be B2B stuff, you know, like when Slack was private still, or even something like Zoom, right? Yeah. That you encounter at work and you get to it interchange or interface with that brand. Right. And so, you know, once it qualifies for that, then we look at stages and buckets, right? Yeah. So, you know, we can invest directly in live deals and we'll invest anywhere from pre-seed through Series B. We'll write checks from $250,000 up to $7 to $10 million on the upper end as the fund gets bigger. We can lead deals. We can also follow. We always invest alongside other VCs and VC partners. Yeah. We can also invest in late stage secondaries, which right now is kind of a wild and precarious place to be hanging out in the current market environment. Yeah. Yeah. And we could talk about that, but we can invest in late stage secondaries. Sure. And then we can also invest actually in other VC funds. And there's limitations to what we can do there. But that's very strategic for us to find emerging fund managers that have a real interesting advantage. Yeah. And then, you know, we'll invest in them and get access to their opportunities. But we can also co-invest as well, which is an interesting lead generation format for us. So long answer, but it's one of the, you know, it's fascinating to dig in under the surface of what makes this different, and not just different, but advantageous in so many ways.
Yeah. I would say that's your edge. Right. So you guys have an edge, whether you're better at whatever people want to decide. But just from listening to that description, you've got an edge in the market, which usually gets people a little excited, myself included. So, you know, to round out this thought, so you have consumer touching stuff, certain stages, Is there an average placement size that you guys like to dance around as far as deploying capital?
So if we just take the scenario of investing in actual live rounds, right?
Sure.
Yeah. It depends, you know. I mean, like for us, I don't know. I've always kind of thought that staging is kind of, I don't know, contrived in a way. Like we've come to this culture of, well, it's a seed stage raise and it's a Series A raise. And,
yeah, very prescriptive.
But like you, yeah. But you look at all this stuff, right? And like the range for a seed round now is anywhere from $1 million to, you know, 15 million. And a Series A is anything from, you know, 3 or 4 million up to 50 million. You know, I mean, like there was a Series A in Utah for 100 million last year. And there's so much, just everything all over the place. It's kind of silly. And I think a lot of that's coming down out of the stratosphere right now and being normalized, of course. But generally speaking, we look at it and say, what is the right thing for this business at this moment in time? Right. And where is it best for us to be able to participate? So, you know, I think it's totally dependent on the nature of the company that we're looking at, the environment that they're in, who else is around the table, how much allocation is available. But again, like we'll write checks anywhere from $250,000. Right now, I'd say $250,000 to 3 or 4 million is really where our heart is at right now at this size of the fund. Right. But a year from now, we'll be writing checks up into that $7 to $10 million range as well.
Wow. Well, that's incredible. And speaking of deploying capital, like, are there any businesses that you guys have invested in? I mean, you just launched, so any ones that you want to bring up? Some of the darlings of your fund that you're really excited about? Or?
Oh yeah, no. I mean, we announced our first 5 investments just before we launched to the public. So we had a private beta period where we raised several $1 million, and we started actually making commitments immediately. So we've been kind of like, we called it spring training. We've been spring training on the deal team for like 9 months. So we've been talking to founders since last fall, and we've talked to hundreds of founders. And so, you know, we were eyeing when we knew we were going to launch, and we had a very mature pipeline. So as soon as money was in the door, we had commitments all ready to go. So, you know, a few of them are super interesting. There's one called Early Bird that is, it's a super interesting investment app. It's a custodial investment app for parents to set up investment accounts for their kids, but it's set up in a social way so that like aunts and uncles and friends and family, instead of like giving you some stupid gift for your birthday, they can commit money into your investment account on your behalf. And then it's all robo invested on, you know, and you can set up those custodial accounts when the child is still in the womb, technically. And so it's like this kids investing app, but it's custodianed by the parents in a safe environment, and they're doing amazing things. So they're great. There's another one called Feet, F-E-A-T, that is a clothing brand that has the potential to be like the next like Vuori. They're blowing up right now. They're doing amazing things. They were born out of this whole, you know, pandemic feel of, you know, wanting to be comfortable in your work environment, but to look professional enough to be on a camera, right? And so it's like this mix of like comfy and business casual kind of thing that is leading into this world of like kind of the deformalization of work environments. But also just like you should be able to go to your yoga class and to the grocery store and jump into work and be wearing the same thing. And they're blowing up. So they're doing awesome stuff. There's another one that is called After.com, and they specialize in the very sensitive, both emotional and time sensitive issues that happen when someone passes away, and helping families to be able to make decisions and find the right partners to help make arrangements for cremation or other funeral services at the end of the process. And that whole industry is archaic. It's been the same for 100 years, and these guys are coming in with technology and helping during that bereavement period when you're, you know, you feel all these emotions when your mother passed away. And what's crazy, right, is that by law, you have 2 hours to assign who is going to take custody of the body. And so if there aren't pre-arrangements made, a person who's mourning the loss of their mother has to be making phone calls and try to figure out pricing to get that stuff to happen. And these guys are like, click of a button, everything's transparent pricing, can get it all taken care of. And it's really amazing. So they're doing really cool things. You know, we've invested into another venture fund as well. It's so her name's Lolita Taub, and her fund is called Ganas. And she's amazing. So she's been at a couple different VC funds. She's got, you know, a good following on Twitter, and her fund is going to be focused on investing about half in Latin America and half in the US. And she's just incredibly well connected. And she's, I have a lot of respect for the way she's building that fund. So there's that one. And the last one, and I'll stop talking. Last one is, it's an olive oil company, an extra virgin olive oil company, direct to consumer, but also like through retail stores and whatnot. That's out of New York, and they're incredible. So it's like the whole olive oil world is there's like a mask on it. Like we all go to the store and we buy extra virgin olive oil off the shelf, but what we don't know is that it's mixed in with all this like really low quality oil, and we don't know it, you know? And so it's extra virgin by definition, but it's really like the lower end of that whole world. And so these guys, they direct source all their olive oil straight from the producers out of this region in Spain that is known for this. And then they package it all up, and they have this beautiful packaging that puts it into squeeze bottles, actually, for you to be able to use at home instead of like a stodgy glass bottle that's hard to get it out of. It's made for cooking. So it's used by 5-star Michelin chef kitchens around the country. But it's packaged up for consumers as well. So you can get it at retail stores across the country. It's cool. Like the products are called Drizzle, which is like a finishing product. You know, you might put on like a caprese salad. And then they have Sizzle, which is made for cooking. You know, like if you're going to cook chicken or something, like it's, I mean, it's just amazing. I got to meet the founders last week in New York, and all these companies are in revenue and they're blowing up. So we're very fortunate with our first batch.
Dude, and I can see that just as you talk about these placements, you're a true VC. It's like you're talking about your own children. You're so proud. I love it, man. For those of you who are listening, you check it out on YouTube and just see the reaction of Jesse as he talks. It's like watching a father talk about how proud he is of his own kids. It's pretty fun to watch. So
I'll take that as a compliment.
Founder shoes. You want to work with a funder who's like also as proud of this product as they are, and they're in his vest hand to provide that air support for the funders. So this is really great. The good VCs, which I would put you in that category, are certainly ones that truly treat it like one of their own kids and part of a family. So very, very admirable, man. You're placing deals. Right. I mean, you guys are off to the races, man. So
I totally agree.
Maybe, you know, where do you see your fund being in even AUM? Like, where are we going? Where are we going to go? Say 12 months from now, where do you see Sweater going?
Yeah. So this is a part where, you know, we didn't say the disclaimer earlier. I should say none of this is financial advice. And, you know, we're all talking about friendly things together. This is not a solicition, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
All that good stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things that I'm very clear about. So we fall under a category, which this is what makes us a cousin to a mutual fund. We fall under a category that's a registered investment company. And within being a registered investment company, it allows you to market to the public, mm-hmm. but there's also a lot of constraints around how you present marketing materials and whatnot. So like one thing we're not allowed to do is to present or imply expected returns. We're not allowed to like provide a target, right? But we can talk about the industry at large and talk about, you know, what other VC funds do and what the industry has traditionally done. And then you draw your own conclusions around what you think Sweater can achieve. So the expected AUM is one of those areas that's kind of like up for grabs. It's a gray area, but I'll tell you, I can give you a range. So, you know, we're looking at raising somewhere between $50 and $100 million in the next 12 months. And then in the longer run, you know, like, I mean, this is an ecosystem play for us, but in the long run, like 5 years from now, we want to have $1 billion under management. 10 years from now, we want to have $10 billion. So we're very ambitious. You know, we're definitely not aiming for the lower end of the spectrum. We're going at it.
We'll get some contact information in the description below for those people who want to reach out to Jesse and his team.
You're welcome to.
And so speaking of that, so here you are starting a business. Can you maybe walk us through and give a sense, especially to the other founders or maybe even some potential LPs, if you call them that, providing those high-end services to both funders and founders?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, I never could have done this alone. So incredibly grateful for everyone that's helped us along the way, both team members and partners. You know, I mean, I'm incredibly grateful for everyone that's surrounded themselves around the mission. So I have two co-founders. So Chad Lukowski and Matthew Klein, they're both entrepreneurs that have built their own businesses before and raised venture money. Chad comes from the investment banking world. He was at Citi for 15 years in a variety of capacities in investment banking. Matthew is a serial entrepreneur. He's built and sold companies his whole life. He dropped out of college and started his first company when he was like 22. It was a denim company, and he built and sold that when he was quite young, honestly, and ended up being in the fashion industry in New York and built technology around the fashion industry later for product and supply chain planning for fashion brands and consumer products. And just incredible people. So Chad now leads all of our investments. So he's our chief investment officer. And Matthew leads all of our customer and client experience.
Nice.
So everything to do with marketing and, you know, the experience that individuals have and encounter inside our ecosystem. So couldn't have done it without those two. And then we have incredible other executives on our team. So we have Emma Clark, who's over all of our operations. And she comes from a venture-backed, you know, company background from a scaling perspective, and incredibly grateful for all she does to help us keep all the plates spinning, because we have a lot of plates spinning around this place. And she's amazing. Our CTO was at SoFi and Amazon and a lot of other technology companies over the last 20 years. And he has this incredible experience where he took SoFi, if you're familiar with SoFi, they're like an $8 billion company now, right? And so they're a fintech company, but he was there in the early days, and he took their Salt Lake office from six engineers to 160 in less than 3 years. And he led that effort internally for them. And so we get his expertise to help us, you know, cherry pick some amazing engineers out of SoFi to come in and help us out. And we have a very strong team there. Yeah. And then we have, you know, teams across all these other sectors that, that we built out. So we've got about 30 employees now.
Yeah.
That do everything from customer success and people who have been around the block inside these direct consumer fintechs to our deal team and people that have been at VC funds in a variety of contexts, you know, to looking at our engineers and, you know, looking at folks that are leading marketing efforts and content efforts. I mean, we really have incredible people around the table.
Wow, that is incredible. So I hope both funders and founders are hearing what Jesse's saying. Is he saying, yeah, we built this thing. I figured it out. I found a way to accomplish the vision I always have, but I couldn't do it alone. So the power of having an effective team, I think both funders and founders would agree, is a pretty big deal. And it sounds like you've put together a stellar team to support your vision. And now you got all these people that are rallying around your cause. I mean, I love seeing this momentum. So good for you. I mean, you have a stellar team. So anyone that you invest in would certainly be lucky to have the horsepower that you bring to any startup. So phenomenal work. So now here you are, you got this fund, you have this stellar team, you're doing deals, you're growing in a non-specified range of investments. And so, you know, I think I hear from a lot of founders, and they're saying, we would love to understand that world of VC. I joke that, you know, a lot of founders think it's some form of witchcraft and they don't understand it. It's a little scary at times and they don't know how to deal with this. And so part of this show of making billions is powering both funders and founders, and also that cross-pollination. So here we are, you and I as VCs, and we're saying, guys, it's okay. We don't bite much, at least not when we're medicated. So when founders come to us, maybe they can listen to this show and we can give them a little bit of insight of what goes through the mind of a VC when they're getting pitched. And so maybe you can paint a little bit of that picture for a lot of the founders. What goes through the mind of a VC at maybe a pre-seed, a seed, a series A? Like, walk us through exactly what a founder can expect on the other side of when asking for money.
Well, you might be right about there being a little bit of witchcraft and, you know, being inside the, or at least some secret handshakes, you know, like whatever you want to call it. I mean, VC is just such an interesting animal, right? I mean, it's very much a culture of people of their own, right? And it's very difficult to break into it. Granted, I never really broke in. I had to build my way in, right? And by many people's standards, I'm probably an outsider, but, you know, whatever. But I'm glad that you're breaching this topic, because I think that one of the most valuable things that a founder can understand is to understand how the VC views them, and not just views them, but views the entire startup ecosystem, that views how they're building their portfolio, that views the obligations that they have behind them to the LPs that are giving them money. And the LPA or limited partner agreements that they are tied to, and how that all sets them up for raising their next fund and understanding their career trajectory and success trajectory. I mean, if you don't understand that, then you're totally going to miss the ball when it comes to how you present yourself and how you can fit inside their success in the future. Yeah. And so I'm really glad that you want to talk about this. And I do feel like, you know, to a certain degree, it's interesting for me to talk about it because I sit on both sides of the table simultaneously. Yeah. You know, we are a VC, we are deploying capital, analyze companies all day long. I'm also a founder and we've raised $15 million in equity at Sweater Inc. level, and we're going to raise a lot more in the future. And so, you know, we play this game and we play it a lot. So where do you want to start? Yeah. Like what's a good area?
So what would be it? What would be, so speaking to founders, what would you tell them is going through the mindset of a pre-seed type of, when a VC is hearing a pre-seed or they're analyzing it, what's going through the VC's mind at pre-seed?
Yeah. So very, very glad that you're being specific because the pre-seed investor is looking for something very different than the seed, very different from Series A and Series B. And that's one of the first things to learn, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're a pre-seed and you're talking to a Series A investor, don't talk to the Series A investor. That's just not worth your time. It's a waste of their time. They might be nice to you, you know, whatever, but like focus on the investors that you have. I would say that like true pre-seed VCs are really rare. I mean, like lots of VCs will say that they invest in pre-seed, but they really don't, right? What they really want is like, you're on the verge of raising a seed and they just want to get there a little early, you know? Yeah. So like the range of what pre-seed means, I think is the first thing to understand. So if you're talking to a VC pre-seed is really looking for like an advance, like someone who hasn't raised money yet that's in revenue and that, you know, actually has a product that they can showcase, but you're not really raising, like you don't have enough there to raise, you know, $3 or $5 million seed round, but you could take a couple of $1 million, you know, or maybe less than $1 million and they could like squeeze their way in there. You know, that's where the VC of pre-seed stands in. If you're truly at an idea stage, you're probably not going to find a VC that will talk to you, or you'll drive yourself nuts trying to find one.
Yeah.
You know, because you'll go through all these ones that are really later stage and they'll just, well, you're a little too early for me. How could we be too early? You're a pre-seed fund. There's nothing earlier than pre-seed, right? But somehow they find a way to tell you that you don't have enough traction. Yeah. So I think that that's a reality. So really like at pre-seed, you're really talking to individual investors or you're talking to accelerator programs like a Y Combinator or a Techstars or an Antler, which I love Antler. They're really attacking the pre-seed space aggressively and in a way that's very founder friendly. And we should talk about them more because I like them a lot. So it's like you're inside this other world and, but whoever you're talking to, number one thing that they're assessing is you at pre-seed. It is 90% you. And they're, you know, what they're testing for and the questions that they ask, like they, let's just, because angels are involved in this, there's a big range of what folks are looking for and what kind of questions they're going to ask you. So let's assume for a second that it's a more sophisticated end of the spectrum of an angel investor. So a sophisticated angel investor or pre-seed fund or accelerator program is 100% examining you. Right. And they're looking for a few things. They're looking to see whether or not you have had exposure inside the venture ecosystem before, because they know darn well that if you haven't, you are going to encounter a lot of bumps and bruises and could potentially break both your legs and die on the trail because you don't understand the ecosystem. It doesn't mean that you have to have been there before, but you need to demonstrate some kind of acumen for the way that the system works. If you don't understand the way the system works, they're not going to trust that you can continue down the rest of the path. They're also going to kind of pressure test to see how well you know the market that you really are trying to attack. And this is effectively like saying, you know, are you an expert in what you do? And it doesn't mean that you have to have spent your career in that space. But like if I'm talking to a pre-seed founder, I'm asking questions just to see how deep the rabbit hole goes with the founder. You know, and I may not know the answers, but, you know, so it's mostly curiosity for me. But if I get in there and I can tell that you don't really know this customer well, you don't know this problem at a, you know, at a deep level, then I'm not going to trust that you have an answer that can solve the problem. If you don't understand the problem, you don't understand the customer base that you're going through, you know? And so I think there's a lot of that there. And then, of course, I mean, there's some mild testing to see if, you know, if you check out on the first two, you know, are you working on something that's actually interesting? You know, and a lot of that, though, I think is at the pre-seed level is mostly about, like, you know, potential more so than facts. Is if you're truly pre-seed and you're pre-product and pre-revenue and whatever else, it's more about, like, if you have identified an interesting problem and you are smart and you are an expert, I need to trust that you have the ability to, you know, walk around this thing enough and go into it enough to find a way to solve it. And that's what you're doing at pre-seed. So I'll stop talking. Long answer. We could talk about this stuff all day.
We really can. You, especially you and I, we could really geek out about this. We're doing this even now. So on pre-seed, it's thing all the way to the finish line. At least help me believe that you can. And then number two is saying, how well do you know the problem? If you don't know the problem, then I'm not so comfortable that you're
100%
know enough in order to find creative solutions that don't exist, right? If you're just coming up with solutions that already exist, then they already exist. Like, there's no more meat on that bone. So understanding, making sure for our founders out there, if you're in pre-seed, make sure that you understand the problem better than anyone else. And make sure that when I talk to my founder, which is essentially following that S-curve that says, I started out here, nothing noteworthy. Then what happened that made you ascend to this level? And talk about how you've ascended to this level. You've understood the problem. You've ascended and managed it to this point, and build confidence in me. Help me believe that you can maintain yourself and others who are going to be employed by you, especially investors who are supporting you. Make sure that I have confidence that you can sustain at this high level. So that sounds like that is an amazing analysis of the mind of a VC when they're assessing a pre-seed.
Exactly.
Now, what
right.
have you found in, yeah. you can either go down the road of seed.
Well, can I add?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, let me ask, I think there's one more nuance that's really important
Please.
For founders to understand.
Yeah.
So what we just talked about,
sure.
in my opinion,
yeah.
is really the sophisticated investor
yeah.
that has, let's just say, written 20 checks before, right? They've been around the block
yeah. Yeah.
in whatever context. You are mostly going to, well, let's say that group is in the minority and you want to yes. find them because you want those sophisticated investors to understand your hero's journey yeah. and catch the vision. And they will be able to pick you out if you know how to do that.
Yeah,
and you want
honest.
Those types of investors on your cap table, 100%.
Yeah.
But there's also all the other investors. And
yeah.
let's just say that they're unsophisticated, right? And they are going to grill you with all kinds of unreasonable
right.
things.
That's right.
And you just have to be ready for it. And you have to not be distracted
yeah.
by it. Now, this group is also most likely to feel FOMO in a big way. And so if you get these nice. Sophisticated investors to actually set a direction for a round, you can get the unsophisticated investors to jump on real yeah. fast. Now, you know, and really gather up the money quickly and get done with a round if you have the right investors organizing things. But before you have that lead investor that's going to take things across the line for you and yeah. set the tone,
yeah.
you'll run into lots of unsophisticated investors
yeah.
that can waste a lot of your time. And the thing about it is that you don't know that they're unsophisticated until after you spend time with them. And then it just is what it is, and you've spent the time. And what yeah. is most important is I see so many founders get distracted yeah. by the feedback and the harsh criticism and the stupid questions that get asked by these unsophisticated investors. And then they end up, like, you know, walking in circles, trying to make adjustments to their story and their pitch for an audience that, frankly, you know, in a way, like, you know, don't toss your pearls before swine. Like, I love all these investors, but, you know, you also need to understand that you don't need to change your story for every single person you talk to, right? You need to be adjusting your story and making it better for those that matter the most. And then these unsophisticated investors, they can come along for the ride. That's great, right? But you also need to be careful when you're going through that, because it's very easy to get caught in the mire, frankly. And again, like, I love these unsophisticated investors to death. They are helping founders. They're putting money into companies. You know, you just, as a founder, need to make sure that you can differentiate and take feedback from the right group as you go through the process. Otherwise, you could definitely get caught in a bad spot.
Yeah, and when we say unsophisticated, that's not a demeaning term. That's typically coming from the SECs. We're saying, there's criterias, and below that criteria, they consider unsophisticated. So what we're talking about is more of the SEC definition. And, you know, the non-SEC definition that we used to use back in the day was triple F, right? Friends, family, and fools. So the friends, family, and fools round. And I think what you're saying, probably going to ask you ridiculous stuff. But really, you know, that's fine. Bring them along for the ride. But really, what you need to keep your eye on the prize is to work with people like yourself or other early stage investors. So I think, you know, sure, in the very early days, you kind of take what you can get at depending on your startup. And so there might be a blend of those. And I love that you drew the line around triple F is saying like, yeah, you know, let them come in or not. Like, don't sweat too much over that. Really keep your eye on the prize, which is preparing for VCs, because they can provide a ton of value if they're involved.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd say VCs or just sophisticated angels, you know, like those that have written a lot of checks and can see and asking good questions, you know, like they're out there. We have plenty of them inside Sweater. I just wanted to state that, because like as a founder, it's so hard to differentiate, especially if it's your first time through the process. It's just incredibly frustrating. So
it is. Move up in different rounds. So we've gone from pre-seed, next round, sometimes we call it seed, and then A, B, and so on. How does that, maybe walk us through how the VC changes their type of analysis and their perspective on kind of more advanced rounds?
So from stage to stage, you know, I think the biggest thing that changes is they're looking, it shifts from being, say, in pre-seed, 90% founders and 10% idea. And as you go from seed to series A to series B, those two start switching priority. Okay. If you're just looking at those two factors. So, you know, like when you get to the seed round, you can't be really pre-product at the seed round, right? You typically need to actually have a product of some sort. You need to be generating some kind of revenue and showcasing that the market exists. And that is an important factor that you have done those things. You can't just have amazing founders and raise a seed round. I mean, you can. Let's just say it's the exception and not the rule. And don't go into it thinking that you are the exception, because every founder thinks that they're the exception.
Yeah, don't be that.
And that's a tough reality and a nice 6 to 12 months of wasting your time before you finally figure out that you're not the exception.
Yeah.
And I don't want anyone to go through that. Yeah. So when you get to the seed round, you really need to have had a product and have some revenue and whatnot. You get to the series A and all of a sudden, like, you have real milestones you need to be achieving, right? Sure. You need to be doing 100K a month in recurring revenue or more. You know, these days, it's probably more like $250,000. Yeah. You need to have a team that is beyond the founders that you can showcase, that can actually execute alongside you, that has stacked expertise in specializing in the world that you operate in, and showcase that you have been able to recruit good talent and that they're staying there and that you have the ability to execute it on the next big steps that are coming, right? Because the traction steps from series A to series B can be very substantial. I mean, you're talking about, you know, going from 100K a month in recurring revenue to 500 to a million in recurring revenue on a monthly basis. And that is a very different business that you're building. And so of course, then you get to the series B and now they're looking at all kinds of other stuff, right? And it kind of starts at the series A, but now they're looking at metrics and they want to understand everything about the funnel inside your acquisition cycle. They want to understand the lifetime value of your customer at a very intimate level. They want to be able to see everything by channel. They want to talk to all of your big clients and customers. They want to see your revenue mix. They want to see that you're diversified across, you know, how you're actually going to survive the business. I mean, there's so much more that goes into a series B than a series A. You're changing and evolving as a company ultimately, but I think the biggest, easiest way to talk about it is that it's, you know, you go from 90% founders, 10% idea to, by the time you get to a series B, it's 90% company, 10% founders. And you're just shifting and going along that curve.
Wow. Now that is the best analysis. And I hope our founders are really picking up on how important this gift really is that you're giving people, is to say, look, man, here's how you tailor your message. Like, all of it matters, but some matters more or less depending on the stage. So I love that. And, you know, speaking about fundraising in the stage, you know, there's been some shifts in the market, but you also pay attention to the macros. So what have you seen in the market? Like, what kind of things are changing, and how, or have you or other founders that you're talking to?
So here's the way that I like to, here's the way that I like to talk about this. And just for the record, I do have an economics degree.
Oh, all right.
You know, so I love talking about economics. I love the macro environment and how that, you know, yes. Like internally, we often, we've got a few people that grew up on farms. And so we often refer to the weather, like as a farmer, you're constantly watching the weather. It affects everything that you do.
Yeah.
And as a VC, the macroeconomic environment is the weather. They're big movements and they affect everything you do. And right now we're in a nasty storm and the storm will pass. And that's the first thing to recognize, right? Things are weird right now. And like, I mean, I spent an hour with a founder today that has the most incredible metrics and traction and trajectory in front of them. And they're just getting screwed in their fundraising. And it makes me sad because 3 months ago, they could have raised 3x the money at way better terms. And they're caught in this weird position and they can't. And so they're looking at all kinds of other alternatives. But anyway, so the way that I like to phrase this is A, it's a storm. It's a moment in time. Yeah. It's going to go away. And that's the first thing to recognize. Don't freak out. The second thing is you have to understand context. So I always like to say, do you know what fundraising was like in 2012, 10 years ago?
Yeah.
And compare that to what it was in 2021. And it is ridiculous. I mean, the average seed round in 2012 was like $1.3 million. Yeah. And the average post money was like $3.5 million, right? The average seed round in 2021 was like $7 or $8 million and average post money of like 32 or 28 or something like that. I mean, it's crazy. Just like absolute night and day difference. And so you look at what happened in the VC space from 2012 through, let's just say 2019, before the pandemic. You had this nice steady increase that made sense, right? The economy was getting better. They were, you know, things were coming out of the financial crisis, right? And things were just getting better and better in terms for the founders in the VC founder relationship. 2020 hit and all VC just paused for 6 months. Nobody knew what was going to happen. Nobody wanted to write checks. And this comes back to the complicated relationship that VCs have with their own funding partners that are giving them money to invest. And it would be irresponsible for them to put money into a company 2 months into the pandemic and then have that company tank 2 months later, right? They can't have that happen. So they all just pushed pause.
Yeah.
And then everything kind of shook out and was like, hey, this looks pretty good. And the government pumped all this money into the system. All governments pumped all this money into the system.
A lot.
And so all this money came whooshing around and came into venture and everyone was like, yeehaw, let's go. And 2021... Time.
Yeah.
2021 was insane. You look at the numbers and average funding amounts and funding valuations were up almost double over what where they were in late 2019 and early 2020 pre-pandemic. And why was that, right? Like it was because there was too much money in the ecosystem and there was just a craze, right? And so you take that into context and you take the repricing that's happening in the market right now and these adjustments that are coming back down to earth. And a lot of founders are pissed off and they're like, how could VCs do this to me? And, you know, all this stuff. And it's like, guys, like 2021 was unrealistic from every measure possible. It was unrealistic. And if you go back and you look at just 2017, 18, 19, and you look at the steps, the positive steps for founders that happened in those 3 years, and you look at what's happening now, and it's just back on the trend line of what was happening from 2012 all the way up through 2019, 2022 is back on that trend line. And it's good. It's fine. Now, the problem for most founders is that they're looking at what could have been last year and they're lamenting that I can't raise a $10 million seed round. I have to raise a $5 million seed round.
Oh, horrible.
My valuation would have been this or that or whatever. And it's like, look, I get it. But honestly, if you haven't raised money yet, you should be freaking grateful that you didn't raise money at those prices last year.
Yeah.
Because with everything coming back to earth, you would be in a pickle trying to figure out how to get the metrics to get up and not have a down round. And so, and if you do find yourself in that position, it's just the way it is. And we could talk about that as a different topic of how founders can try to get through this period and survive the storm. Yeah. But generally speaking, I'd say, yes, repricing is happening. The late stage companies with valuations, you know, say $200 million plus are the ones getting the biggest repricing.
Yes.
There's light repricing happening at pre-seed, seed, and Series A that is happening, but it's not as dramatic as late stage. And generally speaking, it sucks, but it's also necessary. And in the big picture, we're fine.
Yeah.
I'll stop talking. I could rant about this all day.
I know. You're so stoked about all this, and it's getting me excited. I hope the listeners around the world are getting your energy of how passionate you are about this. And I agree. I've seen similar things. The later stage rounds are going through a little bit more of price correction. They all are, but the earlier stage correction is a little bit not quite as drastic. And you mentioned, for our listeners who might be new, Jesse mentioned the word down round. That essentially means you're selling at a valuation lower on this round than you did at the round prior. So that's an issue for all shareholders. It's basically locking in your losses for shareholders, basically. Yeah. So
yeah, it's not good. And you know who takes the majority of that, the brunt of that, are the founders and the employees. Yeah. It's the common shareholders, not, I mean, like, yes, it does hurt your investors as well, but it's going to mostly hurt you. And so there's, you know, it depends on the terms that you got before. nuance inside those papers.
Yeah, you got it. So, you know, as we're rounding third base here, as we start to wrap up, I'm sure at this point, there's a lot of people who are wondering, like, how can they get more involved? How can they reach out to you? And again, we'll include some information. What are some ways that people can get a hold of you?
Yeah, well, I mean, to get a hold of Sweater, I mean, I'd say get to know us. Go download the app. It's free. Yep. You don't have to make an investment to access all of our content. You can go to sweaterventures.com and link to an app store. You can go straight to the app store and just search for Sweater. Yep. We'll show up. You know, I mean, if you want to be an investor in our ecosystem, we'd love that. But, you know, there's also trust there and getting to know us and getting to know the venture capital asset class. So, you know, however you guys want to approach that is just fine. But, you know, there's that element. If you're a founder and you want to talk to Sweater, you know, we've got a team of seven awesome people that all they do is just talk to founders all day. And if you want to do that, you can find me on LinkedIn and send me a message. I do get a little bit inundated there these days. Yeah. Or you can go through the website and you can submit through there as well. We also have venture scouts across the country. So we've got 150 venture scouts, many of whom are... list that on their LinkedIn profiles.
Yeah.
And that's probably the surest way to capture someone's attention because their inboxes are the emptiest compared to the Sweater team that gets pounded on because we're VC and everybody's sending us garbage all the time. Not founders as garbage, but like vendors and, you know, we're getting hit up all the time. So there's a lot of noise in our inbox.
Yeah.
But if you go to one of our scouts, you'll definitely get their attention and then they'll bring it through internal channels as well.
Wow. That's absolutely incredible. Well, that's enough for me and Jesse, everybody. I hope you enjoyed our time together, our discussion. Jesse, thank you so much. You've been incredibly generous with your knowledge and really helping the communities, both on funders and with founders. So in parting advice, I would say, you know, one of the best takeaways from this is learn what the mind of the VC is, learn why they're in the room, and you too will have the skills that you need in your pursuit of making billions.
Wow, what a show. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Now, if you haven't done so already, be sure to leave a comment and review on new ideas and guests you want me to bring on for future episodes. Plus, why don't you head over to YouTube and see extra takes while you get to know our guests even better. And make sure to come back for our next episode where we dive even deeper into the people, the process, and the perspectives of both investors and founders. Until then, my friends, stay hungry, focus on your goals, and keep grinding towards your dream of making billions.